Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors, welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is your first time here, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've helped hundreds of entrepreneurs, founders, consultants write and publish their own book as well. And in that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. A lot of businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million, and they struggle to break through that. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights. And more importantly, how you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and your business starting today. Our guest today is someone whose work is transforming the way that we make decisions in life and business. Dr. Alan Barnard is one of the world's leading decision scientists and a foremost expert in the theory of constraints. In fact, he co-founded Goldratt Research Labs alongside the legendary Dr. Eli Goldratt, who's the creator of the theory of constraints and author of The Goal, one of the 150 top most read books of all time. At Goldratt Research Labs, Dr. Barnard and his team tackle one of the most fascinating challenges in human behavior. Why do people make and often repeat avoidable bad decisions? Through groundbreaking research, they've developed powerful decision support methods and apps that help individuals and businesses make better, faster decisions when it matters most. So if you've ever struggled with decision making, whether it comes to scaling your business, leading a team, or just simply navigating life and some of those big choices, this episode's going to be a game changer. Dr. Alan, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So excited to be here. So this is what I love about your journey is that people, when they kind of look into your background, they're a bit surprised to find out that you actually started kind of more on the technical engineering manufacturing side.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in South Africa, grew up on a small farm, you know, without much resources. And that can work against you. It can work for you. In my case, it worked for me because I realized early on, you know, if I wanted to have nice stuff, I needed to find ways of affording it. So I became an entrepreneur when I was 10. I did everything, delivered newspapers, worked in gardens, tried everything that I could to make enough money. And I also had a grandfather that really, really deeply cared about me. And he gave me this book called The Marquis Who's Who when I was 10 years old. And it was basically a biography of all of the most successful people in the world. And he asked me to read the book and tell him what I'm learning. And I said to him, the first thing that I found fascinating was almost none of the people in the book had perfect starting conditions. They all, you know, grew up in poverty, or they had parents that neglected or sometimes even abused them. They often had learning disabilities. They were awkward, etc. And yet they become so successful. So I said, my first lesson was that it's not your starting conditions that matter. It's your starting assumptions and beliefs that matter a lot. And, you know, I said to my granddad, I want to find a way of helping people identify those limiting assumptions and beliefs that's holding them back. And that got me into decision making, because ultimately the decision that we're making is informed by what happened before. What's the assumptions and beliefs that we have? So that's kind of how I got into that. But I had to pick what I was going to study. I looked at all the fields. I was interested always in many things, but ended up deciding to go and study industrial engineering. And that choice changed my life because, yeah, and I'm going to get emotional. It's like sometimes those small decisions, right, have a big impact, right? And during my course of study, I read The Goal that Dr. Eli Goldratt had written, and I couldn't wait to start my career to start applying this. And my first job was, I was head of engineering at one of the largest cookware companies, and I started implementing theory of constraints, and it changed everything. We doubled the throughput in our factories. We increased our due date performance from 30% to 100% without increasing OPEX or CAPEX. And then as a kind of a reward, our chairman at the time paid for me to go and see Dr. Goldratt when he came to South Africa. This was in 1992. And that first meeting changed everything. I shared with him some big challenge that I had, and he kind of dismissed me. I was furious. You know, he was actually quite impolite. Like, you're quite a lazy guy. Why are you asking me? Just think about it, you know? And he could see I was upset, and he said, do you want your money back? You know, but don't tell me now. Take the evening, think about it. And I did think about it. Because it was a lot of money. But I also thought about the problem I shared with him. And the next day I went back to him, and in my most sarcastic tone of voice of a 21-year-old, I said, you know, Dr. Goldratt, thank you so much for the advice you gave me, you know? And he said, tell me, young man, did you solve your problem? And it was a very complex problem about how to maintain high due date performance if you can't accurately forecast what you're going to sell. And I said, yes, I didn't sleep, but I solved it. And he said to me, how do you feel? And I said, okay, you've made your point. I feel like a bloody $1 million, right? He said, why would I steal that from you? He said, when we give people solutions, we steal that from them.
Wow.
Never do that. Learn to ask the right question. And that was kind of our meeting. And the rest of my life was basically just a follow-up on that as I became really passionate about it. I'd met somebody that kind of shared a goal with me, which is, how do we teach people how to think? How do we, you know, help them find and overcome these limiting assumptions and beliefs in their life?
Yeah. Wow. And you're right, right? I think that's the big thing. There's entire industries just around decision-making at all. So for people who haven't read The Goal, they haven't heard of Dr. Eli, can you briefly summarize like what theory of constraints is and why that is so important, especially in business?
Sure. When you're thinking about trying to analyze or improve or manage any complex system, that could be an organization, it could be a person, right? What makes us complex is many parts, many interdependencies. The traditional way is, you try to analyze and improve and manage every part, hoping that that will help you improve the system. But all that happens is it improves the parts, not the system. So for many, many eons, people know that we should follow a systems approach, that you should always look at the system. But nobody came up with a practical way how. Like, which part of the system do you want me to look at? I can't look at everything. It's overwhelming. And Goldratt was the first one to practically solve that problem. What he discovered was that if you analyze, improve, and manage the constraint of the system, you are in fact analyzing, improving, and managing the whole system. And the analogy is find the weakest link in the chain and make it stronger. Right? So analyze the weakest link, find a way to strengthen it, find a way to manage it. And by that, you're actually analyzing, managing, improving the whole chain. And it doesn't matter whether the chain is 3 links or 3,000. There's always one weakest link. So it was absolutely profound, the simplicity that he came up with, that the first time gave us practical way of applying the systems approach to any system.
So, all right. So thank you for that. Discussion. And it, when you look at it, it's such a simple solution to a complex problem, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's why most people overlooked it. I do feel like most humans kind of, they get enamored with the complexity because it makes them feel like the busy work makes them feel like they're doing something, even though it may not be moving them forward.
Yeah. I mean, another way of thinking about it is to say, how do I differentiate between all the things that I can improve in my life and in my business? And I can always improve everything, right? How do I differentiate between those that I can improve and the few that I must, that will actually help me to achieve more of a goal that's important? That's the problem fundamentally that theory of constraint solves for people.
Love it. So how do you go from that conversation at 21 to eventually co-founding a research lab with the man himself?
Yeah. So during that first meeting, he asked me what my goal was. And as a 21-year-old, you know, and a kid that grew up like a nerd that never had a girlfriend, I had lots of goals, including marrying a supermodel and, you know, driving a Ferrari. But I also wanted to come up with one original idea, you know, so I had all of these. And he was shaking his head and he said, listen, I don't disagree with you, but it's clear that your definition of a goal and mine is different. So he gave me two beautiful definitions that at the time I didn't fully appreciate. He said, the first one is a life goal is something that when you achieve it, you're ready to die.
Wow.
And I said, what do you mean? And he said, tell me. And he loved giving riddles. He said, do you agree that you could die tomorrow? I said, yes. I mean, it's uncomfortable to think about it, but yes. He said, would you want to die without having achieved your life goal? And I said, no. He said, go and solve it then. And my conclusion was that you could never verbalize a goal as a destination. You always have to define it as a journey, something that you can achieve every single day. So I said to him, okay, so my goal is I want to help people make better, faster decisions when it really, really matters. And a good day is when I've helped somebody do that. A bad day is when I didn't. And he said, that's great. And then he gave me the second definition. He said, a life goal is just a dream taken seriously. Do we have a dream? I said, yes. He said, are you taking it seriously? And I went, not really. I'm in corporate, you know, making a lot of money and rising up the top. And he said, start taking it seriously. And I think that's great advice for all of us, right? It takes courage to have dreams, especially big dreams, but it takes even more courage to remind yourself from time to time, are you actually taking it seriously or have you given up on it?
Yeah. Wow. You know, it reminds me, I heard a religious leader one time speak, and I don't remember the context of it, but how he phrased it really made an impact, where he said, I live my life so in such a way that if I died tomorrow, like I would feel fulfilled in my life. And he's like,
Absolutely.
but I plan my life as if I'm going to be around for another 30 or
Forever,
40
yeah.
years.
Yeah, I like that. It's kind of as I the way I think about it is, how do you solve this problem of having high expectations which you can never meet, and that can cause frustration and anger and anxiety and blame and shame, right?
Oh, that's my problem. My high expectations.
Yeah. Kind of Warren Buffett made a joke once. I asked him and Charlie Munger, you know, when you're looking for a partner, what do you look for? And he said, for a long-term relationship. They said, yes. He said, then you only look for one thing. You just look for somebody with low expectations. So my way of solving that problem is, I think it's important to have high aspirations, but low expectations.
So, how would you quantify that?
Yeah, so I have a very high aspiration, right? I want to make a big, big impact on the world. But every day when I don't get distracted, frustrated, angry, blame myself or others. So they're my expectations. I accept reality, right? It's like, this is it. Okay, so I can learn from it. If I'm still not close to where I want to be, what can I learn? What can I do differently? So I think that that balance of having very high aspirations but low expectations, just accepting reality for what it is rather than it causing stress and anxiety, etc.
Well, my own personal experience in how I've perceived my own life and the people that I've worked with, primarily the frustration comes from people that have expectations, is just a fancy way of saying they want to be in control. And so when they don't reach that thing, they're losing the personal feeling is I don't have control or I'm losing control. And then that turns into anger and frustration because it's this carefully little cocoon of control I've created is suddenly, you know, like reality is like, hey, you don't
Yeah.
actually have a lot of control of many things, so.
And I think that's what happened to most people, and especially entrepreneurs, right? You start off with very high aspirations around the impact that you want to make and the income that you want to earn. And over time, what seems to happen is, you know, that gap grows larger and larger. Expectation, as you get older, I should have been further along this journey, right? And then what we do is we try to find a solution outside. We read more books, we attend more masterminds and conferences, and all that does is it increases our potential, but it doesn't increase the result. So we're making the problem worse. It's like potential energy versus kinetic energy. You know, unless you actually act on it, you won't get the result. And when that gap becomes intolerable, basically only a few things can happen. Some people choose to find someone or something to blame for the gap. Others choose to start lowering their expectations. Both of those are effective because if the gap remains big, it creates tremendous anxiety and stress in our life. So you have to find a way to close the gap. Dr. Goldratt taught me was there's a third alternative, which is to understand the gap and to see what could I have done differently to get better results. And his conclusion is, where's your constraint? You know, you have this podcast about growth, right? And what theory of constraint says is every system, doesn't matter how small or big it is, it will have at least one constraint. You know,
But
all of it will manage you.
on a personal level, that's painful because all I can do is look in the mirror and be like, oh, I'm looking at the constraint.
Exactly. The bottleneck is always at the top of the bottle, right? That's the whole thing. It's always at the top of the bottle. That's, yeah.
All right. So how did the discussion then, I mean, this is what amazing advice and sort of insights to get at a young age, which I can see how that completely directed you. So how did the Goldblatt Research Institute come around or the labs come around?
Yeah, so part of it is Ellie's own story. He became very successful when he discovered that there was a different way of scheduling complex manufacturing plants. So his first business was actually a business called Creative Output that developed software called Opt. And this was in the early 1980s. They were larger than SAP at that time. They were one of the fastest growing companies. All the big companies bought their software because it solved a problem that had never been solved before. Is how do you consider constraints when you are scheduling and making commitments and decisions, etc. And he got frustrated because the software created almost a perfect schedule, but it caused some of the resources to be idle most of the time to ensure that the bottleneck is never starved or blocked. And people don't want to stay idle, right? Yeah. It makes them feel exposed. So they would constantly adjust the schedule and release more work to keep all the non-bottlenecks busy. And that just created chaos. So he wrote the goal essentially as a user guide to say, please don't make this mistake. The only resource that you want to have 100% utilized is the bottleneck. Everything before it and after that will need protective capacity to ensure it's never starved or blocked. So he wrote a book just to solve that problem. And then it became this underground success story. He ended up writing letters to the CEOs of the company that bought his software, wrote a letter and sent them a copy of the book and said, please read this book, else you won't get value from this big investment that you made in my software. And to his shock, he never heard back from them, but he got orders, but for books, not for the software. And he ended up like Steve Jobs being fired from his company because he said, we can't sell company software if we don't teach them what change they have to make in their assumptions and decision-making, else they won't get value from it. And that basically, after he got fired, he started the Goldratt Institute, Avram Y. Goldratt Institute, named after his father. And that's where he started focusing on, you know, the thinking processes and all of that stuff. So I kind of had a similar journey. I was in corporate, I got heavily involved. I had my own business. We were developing software, etc. But always had this pullback of doing something more meaningful. And when we connected, we ended up co-founding the Goldratt Research Labs around 2009. And the idea was that our mandate was to find wicked problems that hasn't been solved for a long time. An example of that is when you think about any supply chain, not only there's shortages, but there's also surpluses. How can it be? How can both happen at the same time? Or you have long lead times and poor due date performance. Like, how can it be? So those are the type of things that we wanted to work on. And I was just very privileged. He ended up, he sadly passed away in 2011. But up to that point, you know, I got a week of his time and we just worked on big, big problems. We started working with some of the biggest companies in the world, like Cisco Systems and ABB and Tata Steel, etc., focused on finding what's the wicked problem and constraint in that industry that's blocking them from really scaling up to their potential, and then working with them to come up with hypothesis, test it, and find solutions to it.
Wow. So what are a couple of the big ideas that you guys tackled during that period of time?
Yeah, so one was something that you might resonate with is working in the book publishing industry, right? Very close to Ellie's heart. And we were contacted by Penguin Random House. At that stage, they were just Random House before the acquisition with Penguin. And they came to us and said, we have a wicked problem. You might be interested to solve, help us solve. We haven't found a solution. 40% of every book that's printed comes back for shredding. Yep. 40%. Yep. And we are the best, right? There's some that is at 70%.
Yeah, what people don't realize, and I got this because I have an understanding of this, is what's interesting. So when you see the books in the bookstore and the grocery store or whatever, those books are there, the stores will only hold them for so long.
Yeah.
And then they can send them back for a refund. But when they do that, they have to rip the cover off of the book because
shipping costs, right?
Yeah. And so it's fascinating to me that it's like, we don't give these books to libraries. They literally have to destroy them.
Yeah.
It's just so bizarre to me.
It's terrible because you walk into a distribution center of one of these big publishing companies, and there's literally two sides. There's the light side where the teams are energized. You feel the energy. All the latest books are going out there and everybody's excited. And the other half is when these same books are coming back already for shredding. And so they said to me it was a $150 million problem if they just took the printing cost and the distribution cost there and back. One of the things that we almost always do as part of our projects is we build simulation models of that system because it's just too complex to understand. And the simulation model helped us to understand that this wasn't a $150 million problem. It was a $1.5 billion problem. And the reason for that is when you think about where's the constraint in that supply chain, the amount of shelf space and cash of the retailer, that determines how many books are shown to the retailer. This is, you know, before Amazon, of course. Right? And
that's just $150 million problem for them. Yeah, but you also had the other publishers that had the same problem.
So it was 10x what they thought. It wasn't 150, it was 1.5 billion. And then what we noticed was that there was a standard rule in the book publishing industry that when I publish my first book, right, I go out to all the retailers and I ask them, you know, how much do you think you will sell? And I'm asking them for a specific number. How much do you think you will sell in 3 months? Right. And then they give the numbers back. So this gives everybody confidence about it. And what I found out was we were able to access the data of Random House Publishing for Barnes & Noble. Right. And to my surprise, think about the lifetime sale of a book. Now think about the first order quantity for that book. So your book could sell for decades, right? Could sell tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies. So what should 3 months worth of sales represent of that total? It should be 5%, 10% maybe, right? What we found out was that in 86% of the cases, 86% of all books, the first order from Barnes & Noble was more than the lifetime sale of the book. So what we realized was the constraint was the shelf space and cash. The problem was they were placing way too big orders early on. And as a result, no sophisticated replenishment system based on what's actually selling is going to solve the problem, right? And then for that whole period, you don't know what the hell your sales were because most of it will come back. So the solution was, how frequently can you actually get a book to a retail store anywhere in the US? And you probably know the answer. It's a couple of times a week. So why are you asking them for 3 months of sales forecast? Why don't you just ask them, what's the most that you think you'll sell in a week or even 2 weeks? And that was the solution.
Way different numbers coming in.
Very different numbers, right? Because then worst case, if they don't sell it, at most you're stuck with 1 or 2 weeks of inventory. And if it does, you get fast feedback and you have capacity to quickly replenish. That to me is like a really good example. Very complex problem, hasn't been solved for ages. And it was all because they were using the wrong rule to make decisions about what that first order quantity.
Reminds me of that meme that goes around online where the answer was so simple that it's like, you slap your head and then you see the room of 600 people slapping their heads going, why don't we just ask for 1 week of sales instead of 3 months?
Dr. Goldratt used to joke about this. He said, you know, as a physicist, your highest prize is winning the Nobel Prize in physics, right? Yeah. And he said, do you know what the real criteria is for them to decide on who won the prize? He said, you can win it with a three-page paper. The only criteria is that when your peers read your paper, and I go, how could we have missed it?
and for normal people, we're thinking he was just solved some huge problem. But in the reality, that's so funny. So this may be a question you may or may not know the answer of. But one of the things that's fascinating, and this is personally, I think, one of the reasons why the goal has withstood the test of time, is that he wrote that as a fictional story using the Socratic method. You know, I think in the world I live in, most people are like, I have my process. Let me share my process, give you some case studies, and then show you why you should do it. So he even with his book, he went completely. Did he ever talk to you about why he chose to use that method for writing that first book? Why he decided to do it as a kind of a fictional story with Socratic method versus just straight up like, hey, dummies, like, here's how to use the software better.
And I mean, he paid for it initially, right? It was the first time that a fictional story, a fable, had been written as a management textbook. So when he wanted to find a publisher, nobody wanted to publish him.
They don't get it.
But if you want to write a textbook about theory of constraints and opt, happy to publish it. You want to write a love story? No, okay, you're a famous guy. Well, we'll print it. A life story with the management, it's like nobody wanted to publish it. But he basically stuck to his guns because he said else he would be a fraud. He wanted to practice what he preached. And he preached that the best solutions start with the right questions and that the book should guide the reader to invent a solution with the character. Because there was a character called Jonah, which is the mentor, and Jonah had this irritating and frustrating habit to never offer solutions, only to ask questions. So it was absolutely deliberate, but initially it was a huge risk for him. But it turned out that was, you know, that's what we learn through stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only reason we remember. It's interesting because there's, you know, even in the speaking circuit, even the personal development circuit, Tony Robbins, you know, 3 days of, you know, a relentless, like, energetic beatdown to, like, get your conscious mind out of the way. And then people say, well, what do you remember about the 3-day event? And usually it's like, oh, that story he told about XYZ, right? They just got 72 hours of content and they're walking away with like one or two stories because that's what we impacted with. So you've worked with some of the biggest companies in the world. Let's take it a step back, because a lot of the people I'm right working, doing the show, working on the book I am right now, because I see a lot of companies sort of get stuck in the $1 million a year range and they can't get out of that. So what's the difference between somebody that's stuck at $1 million versus somebody like Cisco, who's doing $500 billion a year, right? Or whatever it was at the time. Like, are the theories of constraints, is it just, it's the same for everything at every level? And if, I guess where I'm asking that is, like, what are the things that usually keep people stuck from ever being able to get beyond the 7-figure mark, when other people will come along and go, you know, $1 million the first year, 5 the second, 25 the third?
Yeah, I think it can be broadly classified into two areas, right? If you think about where can a constraint be, right? So if you have a clear goal about the impact or income that you want to make, the first constraint could be that there's just not enough demand for the product or service that I'm offering, right? And that to me is like a market constraint is kind of the one that rules them all, right? If you don't solve that problem, you can't scale. So it's by far the most important, but also the most challenging problem to solve. If you can find a way of generating more demand than what you have capacity for, it's an easy life, right? The second one is, you might have enough demand, but you don't have enough capacity to reliably deliver that demand in order to meet the goal. So that's broadly the second type of category. And then the other obvious ones is, I have enough demand and capacity, but there's some external resource, a supply side thing that I don't have enough of, or I don't have enough cash. Mm-hmm. Most businesses go bankrupt, not because they have not enough demand or capacity or supply, but because they simply run out of cash. So if I take my own business as an example of the second type, we grew very quickly to $1.5 million, right? And then we got stuck. Why? Because the service that we were offering required us, right? So even though we could charge through our business model bonuses based on the results that we were delivering, there was still a cap to how much you could do. And it took me a long time to figure out, like, how can I overcome that? And I realized that for me, part of every project, we were developing some kind of custom software simulation, digital twin decision-making app. And it's like, why can't I develop a generic version of that that I can sell over and over again? Mm. And the other part was, you know, rather than getting a nice bonus based on the results, is it possible to get bigger bonuses? Is it possible to get equity in return for actual results, sort of a consult for equity model? Sure. And that was what I've been working on in the last couple of years, is basically changing my business model from essentially providing joint research projects like what we did at Random House Publishing and Microsoft and Tata, et cetera, and getting well paid. But there's a cap. You can only do 2 or 3 of those a year. They are so big, they totally consume you. If you think about a Cisco, right? If you're dealing with something that's scalable, like software, and to some degree, even hardware, if you can, you know, manufacture high volume, the only thing that will block you is ultimately a demand constraint, or sometimes it could be a supply constraint, like you run out of chips, which happened, you know, after COVID. Mm-hmm. People overreacted and suddenly there was not enough chips available. It could also be cash, but that's sort of broadly, like, again, the same principle. Where's the constraint? What's limiting me? It's not many things. It's one thing or maybe few.
So for somebody listening to this episode, reading this chapter in the book, and theory of constraints is new to them, where's the best place for someone to start to really, I guess, begin a journey into mastering the theory of constraints and how to actually apply it and implement it?
I think Goldratt's books are great starting points. Reading The Goal or watching a movie, there's a movie that was made that's actually pretty good, you know, that takes you sort of through 5 steps of what Goldratt ended up verbalizing as what the 5 focusing steps, right? He said, it starts off with step 0, which is, do you have a goal? Is it clear enough that not only you know what work you have to do, what product or service that you have to provide to make that impact or income goal, but have you defined it clear enough that you know what resources is needed and how much of every resource is needed? Right? If I want to feed 1 million people, How much demand do I need? Well, I need a queue of 1 million people waiting to be fed. Do you have that? No. Okay, well, that's the one thing. Go and find 1 million people that want to be fed. Okay. Or I want to make $1 million. Do you have them queuing outside? How much are you charging for your product? $1. Okay, do you have 1 million people? No, well, I charge, you know, $1,000. Okay, do you have 1,000 people waiting? So that's step one, is identify the constraint. Is it demand, capacity, supply, cash, or what's more frequently the case, took us a long time to discover this, is our limited attention. Actually, enough of all of those.
Attention. It always comes back.
Yeah, because we're so distracted, we don't end up doing anything properly. We're constantly distracted, right? Step two says, okay, now that you have the constraint, decide how to better exploit and not waste it. So if it's the market, you know, what are your existing customers? Are they buying everything they need from you, right? What's your market share? Like, what can I do? What are the conditions that will get them, like Jay Abraham says, to pay more willingly, buy more frequently? That's all exploiting better what you've got. If you have a machine and that's the constraint, is it running 24 hours, right? What's blocking you from making sure it's never starved, never blocked? That's exploiting better what you've got. Same with supply or cash. Then the third step is, now that you've made that decision, subordinate everything to it. Don't get distracted, right? Mm. Change any policy measurement that's in conflict with that decision. It could be that you have an incentive scheme that is in conflict with that decision. Step four is, if it's still a constraint, only now go and elevate it. Go and get more. If you have a market constraint, now is the time to add another product or go into a new market. But don't do it before then. Most people jump to elevate. That's, I think, probably the most generic mistake that you have probably seen and I see all the time with entrepreneurs, is they try to do too many things too soon. Like, pick one thing.
I don't know what you're talking about at all. I've never heard that.
Yeah, it's hard to practice what we preach, right? Like, pick one thing and do that really well. And only when you run out of runway do you start the next. I was the same in the beginning, right? I have hundreds of things that I've developed. And you realize at some point, like, okay, how can I become successful at one of them? Because I can't be successful at all of them. So it's only elevate the constraint, go and get more of that thing, right? When I've fully exploited what I've got. And then the last step was a warning that Goldratt gave. He said, do not allow inertia to cause a constraint. Don't get stuck. The real goal is a process of ongoing improvement. And that's the title of the goal, actually. You know, he talks in the goal about the goal is to make money, etc. But then he reminds you, that's not really the goal. Whatever your goal is, the real goal is ongoing improvement. Whether it's impact or income, you need to have a process that takes you back all the time. Find a constraint, exploit it, don't waste it, subordinate, elevate, go back to step one, right? Mm-hmm. As a constraint move, where has it moved to? So I think that's a really reading and understanding the goal and really understanding the five focusing steps. That is the essence of everything about fear of constraints that you need to know. If you want to get more details, like, I'm in projects, how does that apply to project management? He wrote a book called Critical Chain that shows you how to apply the five focusing steps to projects. If I'm in distribution and retail, he wrote a book called Isn't It Obvious that shows you how to apply that. And that was all of these books, by the way, are fables, right? But Isn't It Obvious is a fascinating one. When he was starting to work on it, he asked me a really interesting question. He said, the character and the goal, Alex Rogo, do you think that he could have invented this amazing solution without Jonah, who was his mentor, the guide in the hero's journey, right? The one that asked all the right questions. And I said, wow, that's a good question. And he said, can we think of an environment where there was no guide and still the person made a breakthrough? And I shared with him a couple of examples. I said, imagine you have a crisis, right? Say you have a crisis of capacity. Normally, you get an order from a customer of 1,000 and you make the 1,000 and you ship it. But suddenly you don't have enough capacity. Now that customer phones in and says, I want 1,000. And you say, sorry, I don't have 1,000. How much do you really, really need? What if I gave you 200 a week? The guy says, yeah, actually, you know, the 1,000 is kind of what I need over a month or two. So 200 a week will be fine, right? Suddenly, you stop producing stuff that's not needed. Inventory turns go through the roof. And rather than making 30% a month, that retailer can now make 30% a week, right? So everybody benefits. But guess what happens after the crisis? You go back to the old rules. Rather than thinking the rules that helped me to get out of the crisis, why should I not be using those rules all the time? And it might help me to avoid a crisis. So that was like profound. And that's kind of how he ended up writing the book, is the character faces a crisis. He has to change the rules. He has to break many of the rules. He gets out of the crisis. The crisis is over. And he goes back to the normal and his performance drops. And it takes him some time to figure out it was just the rules that I changed.
Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. So somebody wants to get involved with either the labs or bring you on to consult with them. How do people find you and get in touch with you?
So Dr. Alan Barnard is my handle on all social media. I have a YouTube channel, I'm on LinkedIn, etc. And then they can also search on the Amazon. You know, I've got a couple of books like My Impossible Decision and Impossible Unless. It's all available there, and the Theory of Constraints Handbook. So that's the best way to communicate. And our apps, our whole range of apps is available on harmonyapps.com.
Harmony apps. I love it.
Yeah. So I have dralanbarnard.com, goldenresearchlab.com. But if they're interested in the decision-making apps and our digital twins, it's on harmonyapps.com.
Love it. Thank you. I like to end every conversation with three personal questions. So here we go. If you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
I think it's what I just mentioned, is do not be tempted to be distracted. Focus, 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 right? That's the ring that rules them all, is the ability to be focused and remain focused.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest superpower in today's world for sure. What belief or mindset shift had the biggest impact on your success and happiness?
I think it was this idea that, you know, it's not the starting conditions that we have in life that matters. It's our starting assumptions and beliefs. And related to that is, because in science we know you can't prove any hypothesis or belief or assumption to be true or false. You can only prove it to be false. It's more useful to think about our beliefs and assumptions as whether it's helpful or harmful. Keep the helpful ones, get rid of the harmful ones.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good insight. Final question. What's the best investment you've ever made in yourself?
I think it's signing up with coaches. You know, I was very privileged to have Dr. Goldratt as a mentor when he sadly passed away. I reached out, and today I have incredible honor to have coaches like the Jay Abrams, etc., that's been there, done that. And, you know, I love the advice that Daniel Kahneman gives, you know, when you're trying to find a good coach or advisor. He said, of course, they must have intuition and experience about what you're asking advice about, right? But two other criteria: they must like you, which means they care about the outcome, but they shouldn't like you too much. You want them to be honest, brutally honest sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, with my books, I make it a point to hire complete strangers to do what they call a beta read. And I'll pay them to read the book. But that's because I know that's the only way I'm going to get honest advice. Because it's what was the statement I heard? One of my partners in another business, he's a really accomplished author. And he always says, he's like, look, everybody says, well, I don't need readers. Like, you know, I give it to my friends and families. And he's like, they won't be honest with you. And he's like, no, my friends and family are always honest with me. And he said, no, your friends and family are honest with you to the degree that they know you can take, because they don't want to hurt your feelings. So they'll be honest to a point, but so getting outside feedback is good. And you know, that it's interesting. The coach thing comes up in these conversations a lot. A lot of the successful people we've interviewed have talked about the power of having a coach helping you get past your own sort of roadblocks. So yeah, don't underestimate that for sure. Well, Dr. Alan, thank you so much for your time. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Awesome. Thank you so much.